It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we learn about the history of the blockbuster movie, and we talk about films like Close Encounters of the Third Kind and ask you about your summer classic picks. That's coming up in just a bit. First, when schools closed in March of last year, students, teachers, and parents turned to screens for many aspects of daily life, from remote learning to keeping kids occupied. 15 months later, it's the middle of summer, and some parents are finding they can't quite pry the screens away from their children. Our guest is here to guide us through reinstating screen time limits for kids and teens, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Parents, grandparents, and teachers, have you noticed kids becoming more attached to screens in the last 15 months? Did you have to throw screen time limits out the window at the onset of the pandemic? Have you tried, maybe now that we're in the summer, to reinstate them? And what strategies have worked for your kids, and maybe what advice would you like from our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Natasha Burgert is a pediatrician and spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Burgert, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So let's go back a little ways. Screen time was something that was becoming maybe a little bit more of a concern before the pandemic. So let's not talk about the pandemic right now, but what were some of the concerns regarding screen time when things were slightly more normal?
Sure. So back in 2019 days, I think we were talking about screens a lot. Certainly in my pediatric office, parents were worried that screens were interrupting some joys of childhood and the normal childhood development. And that's what research consistently had shown. We're trying to limit the hours that our kids were having on devices, limiting the entertainment time they have in order to do the real 3D real-time activities that kids need to do to grow and to develop normally.
So now let's reinsert the pandemic here. So kids, families, everything needed to go online pretty rapidly. Kids in particular had to start going to class via Zoom. You know, what were some of the consequences of the last year when it came to screen time?
Well, I think screen time in general, if any of your listeners' families are certainly like mine, you know, screen time was no longer a thing because screen time was all the time. We had virtual school. We had working from home. We had FaceTime and Zooms with grandma. Our social events were on the screens. My teenager's connections to all of her peers were on the screen. I mean, it seemed to be all of the time one of our family members was using a device. And to no fault of our own, and certainly I don't think our family's experience was an exception. I think the challenge and maybe the answer to your question is maybe there is no answer quite yet. I don't think we really know what the long-term consequences are going to be with essentially 18 months of our kids attached to devices. We don't know how that's going to be affecting their academic progress from last year, their emotional dysregulation, their social skills, all of those things I can only anticipate are hindered using those screens, but certainly kids are resilient and can bounce back. I just don't know what the fall is going to hold for these kids after they have to put down those devices.
It certainly does seem as though time will tell there, especially because screens, you know, TVs have been around for maybe 60 years or so, I'm guessing. I'm trying to do quick history here, but now the onslaught of screens with small handheld devices to TVs, all of that have really kind of changed the game. I want to take a call really quickly. We have Beth, who called in at 800-642-1234. She is from Door County. Hi, Beth.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. This was an issue that just happened yesterday and today. We have three families that are together for a vacation in a beautiful beach town, And the four children completely changed personalities and then melted down when any screen time was taken away from them, to the shock of the grandparents, who actually brought up to us as the moms, you know, we're seeing you on the screens too. And we're saying, no, we're just checking our email. We're just looking at this. And then I started to realize, like, wow, no, I'm really hiding behind this screen. And I'm watching these children kind of push me, and I'll say, 5 minutes, you're going to get off. And then 5 minutes turns into half an hour, turns into an hour. Luckily, I broke the internet by accident yesterday, and the kids had no more screen time, but not before the grandmother said no more in my house. It all kind of happened at the same time, and the kids were doing puzzles today, asking thoughtful questions, running around with the dogs, and now we're at the beach. And we're all kind of like breathing a sigh of relief and wondering the same thing of, what's going to happen this fall, you know? And I'm kind of sitting here having this very pensive, poignant moment. So it was fortuitous that I got to tune in today. Thanks.
Wow, Beth, thank you so much for that call. And Beth hits on a lot of different issues there, not just kids using screen time, but the generational use of screens, where parents might think, well, I can be on because I'm checking my email. But, you know, kids kind of, they see and they mimic their parents. Have you seen, again, thank you to Beth for being the example here, you know, parents setting certain examples for their kids?
No, I think that's a fabulous story that Beth shared with us, because so many of us are sharing that. And I think the just like you had mentioned before, JC, like, screens used to be on the TV. It used to be a family event. We'd all like have an activity or a show or a game that we wanted to watch together. And that TV was facilitating that social time with our friends and family. And screens today, since they're on our pockets, have become a very individualized activity. We don't share screens typically with our entire family when we're checking our email. And certainly our kids are watching different Netflix shows than maybe the adults are watching the Netflix shows, which makes it a really disjointed pastime. That also becomes a real self-serving and a really gratifying activity that's actually changing our brain chemistry a little bit to reinforce that type of behavior. So when Beth was at the beach and at this beautiful place to spend time with her family, the kids' brain chemistry was telling them that that individual screen time is what really is going to bring satisfaction and calming instead of that, what we would like to have, that idyllic summer at the beach and being playing outside and talking with grandma and grandpa. You know, I think breaking the internet was definitely a good choice. It was very fortuitous for their family, but it can be really challenging to kind of withstand some of those battles. Kids are, and adults too, are going to have to make very conscientious choices in order to wean themselves off of these devices in some way, to kind of reestablish that brain hormone balance that we need in order to self-regulate, have emotional stability, get calm, and get entertainment without having to grab that device in our pocket. And just like anything in parenting, for all the parents listening, we know that if we want our kids to eat broccoli, we've got to eat broccoli. If we want our kids to do yoga and mindfulness, we have to do yoga and mindfulness. And there's no difference from the screens. If we want our kids to really have some boundaries with screens, we have to demonstrate that on our own. And that is really challenging for families right now who are working at home and do have those work responsibilities, in order to demonstrate that balance with screens and that healthy relationship. I think we all struggle with that every day. But there are some things that we can do in order to help that a bit.
Dr. Burkert, can you tell us what some tips and tricks there are for parents out there, for adults in general who maybe not have kids, and for kids that they might, pull that back a little bit?
Yeah. You know, I want to respect the kids and the families that we've all been working very hard this last year and a half. And things have changed. Our environment, our utility of these devices has literally been life-saving for some of my kids. And it was the only way to connect to therapists, to connect to their friends, to connect to their families during this time of chronic stress. So we all have to give ourselves a little bit of a break, okay? Like the kids are going to be okay. We're going to be okay. It's going to be those simple changes and those really small changes that we do over the next few weeks to prepare ourselves for the transition into the fall. A couple things that I might suggest for us as adults is as we're trying to find what that healthy boundary is for our, particularly our work life and home life, which has been all one big muddy pile this last year and a half, is if we do have to check emails or if we do have to take a call or if there is a document that we're waiting for that we're working on, articulate out loud what you're doing when kids are in the room. So for example, I'm not just going to pick up my device and check my email. I'm going to say, you know, Johnny, I'm expecting an important email from work. I'm going to check my phone for a minute to see if that email came in, and then I'm going to put it down. You're telling him that I'm not what you're telling your kiddo in that moment is, I have to disengage. I'm articulating that I'm disengaging with you for a purpose, for my purpose of work. And then I'm going to put it back down and re-engage with you. I think that's a much different experience than me just sitting on the couch and strolling through Instagram when a kid's watching TV. Like it's telling them that device has a purpose. The device has a utility. I need to do that for work. And then I'm going to have the boundary of putting it back down. I also think during these times when things are a little bit upside down, it's really hard to say with a firm hand, you're only going to get 2 hours of screen, or you're only going to get 2 hours of Fortnite, or whatever it is that you're trying to kind of manage. I think more importantly is to remember kind of the broader things that make a family a family. We want to get back into good sleep habits. I'd start there. We want to get back into having family meals together as much as we can. It's another great place to start. Let's build into the time and the important things for our mental and physical health, good nutrition, and great sleep, and then see if we can prioritize those things that make us a family. Where are screens going to fit in outside of those things? It's a lot easier for me to tell my kid when they can use the screen than when they can't. And if I'm going to get screen time, then they're not going to ask me about it quite as much.
We are talking to Natasha Burgert right now. She's a pediatrician and spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics, and she's helping us understand the appropriate levels of screen time for kids, and is also here to offer some tips to get kids off their phone, and also for adults and parents to get off their devices as well. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Tell us about how you take screen breaks. Call in with your questions. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up this conversation in just a minute right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we are continuing our conversation about reinstating screen time limits for kids and maybe even adults. After a very virtual year, our guest is Dr. Natasha Burgert. You can join in on the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Before the break, you said something that piqued my interest about brain hormones in kids specifically. Can you talk about how, screen time is linked to the creation of some brain hormones and what brain hormones we're seeing really activated in the brain when kids are looking at screens?
Well, it's certainly not just kids. I mean, it's us too. That's why these apps are so addictive and how these devices have become so ubiquitous. I think, you know, we start to see some hormone surges that are our pleasure hormones when we start to get that instant gratification that these screens provide. They also are wonderful tools that give us the intermittent satisfaction when we are rewarded certain points or streaks or rewards for our interaction or opening the apps and engaging with them. Those particular hormones are really strong, anyone who has ever experienced addiction behaviors in their family, it's very similar. So it's hard. As a result of that, I think we have to be kind to ourselves and we have to be kind to our kids when we think about trying to rein in some of the screen time, that we have to be respectful that this is a neurobiological change that's happened over the last 18 months. And it's not going to happen overnight that we can just kind of rip it away. This is a small step, a conscientious step, a plan to kind of bring those hours back over the course of weeks, in order to be able to transition that a little bit more kindly from our pandemic days to hopefully a more normal fall.
I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Jeff in Wausau. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
And what did you want to call in to talk about, Jeff?
I wanted to share with your listeners something that we instituted about a year and a half ago. Nowadays, everybody is so busy that I instituted a family dinner where my children and my girlfriend's children come over to our house one Sunday every month and bring the grandkids over. And the first thing they do when they walk in the house is they put their cell phones into a wicker basket. They cannot touch them until they get ready to leave that night, because we got to the point where they were texting each other sitting in the living room. And I said, enough is enough.
I think we've all been there, Jeff, where we sometimes might text someone in the same room, maybe surreptitiously. And, you know, Jeff brought up something that I think sounds really, really interesting, which are clear expectations and boundaries that people are aware of in advance. It's not something that the kids suddenly show up and they take away their phones. The kids show up and they know that their phone goes in that basket. What do you think about this routine that Jeff has implemented?
Jeff is a smart man. I think having that boundary is a wonderful way to promote the value of being together. That's a value that all families share. And the key to that success, exactly as you inferred, is you know that expectation before you walk into the door. Not only do I like that for meal times or for family events like that, but if you were ever invited over to my house for a slumber party, your kids are going to put all of their devices in a basket when they come over, because if they're coming over to my house for a slumber party, they're there to spend time with each other, not their phones. So I think you can implement that at certain parties. You can implement that at events, certainly family times. It doesn't have to be every single time, but I love that boundary that has been created by Jeff and his family to prioritize that family time in an appropriate very compassionate way.
And Dr. Burgert, I want to go back to something that you were talking about before we took Jeff's call, which was treating everyone going through maybe a little screen time withdrawal, which, as we've talked about, has a biological component with kindness. And so for parents that, you know, maybe have reached 15 months after the start of the pandemic, a desire to reduce that screen time, you know, I'm going to guess cold turkey is not the way to go with our kids.
You certainly could, but that's going to make for a really difficult week. And I certainly have some of my families that kind of reach that wit's end, maybe a little bit like Beth, where the internet is just broken and we're not doing it anymore. And some kids can respond to that, but I think we have to respect all of our kids as individuals. And some of that emotional dysregulation that's going to come with tech withdrawal is really going to make for a very miserable few days. And then it gets so bad that people just don't see it through, right? So, which I totally get. I prefer a little bit more of a gentle response, and to think of the times in your family life when tech is really interfering with the health or safety of your kids. And in my house, that biggest thing is going to be sleep. So we were very guilty during the pandemic of really having some sleep disruption. My mind was racing. My kids' minds were racing. You know, we didn't really have a morning routine anymore because we had all this virtual school. And so we kind of fell into this bad habit of falling to sleep to the TV at night, just watching some distracting shows. And so maybe if that's like a problem for you, or if that's a screen time problem that you wanted to wanted to correct. It's not about just telling your kids to go to bed at 9 o'clock, just cold turkey. It's saying, okay, now we're going to listen to some music. We're going to be listening to a podcast or listen to a story. Or if we really need that screen, instead of just keeping it on until we fall asleep, let's put on the sleep timer and give ourselves 20 minutes. And then we're going to try to fall asleep in that time and the TV is going to turn off. It's about finding some middle ground in those specific instances and where screen time is a problem and where it's really impeding health and safety.
So we are still in the pandemic. Things are still traumatic. They are still stressful. What advice do you have for parents right now who maybe do want to reduce screen time, but right now for their kids, it's helping them get through this?
No, absolutely. And I think we're all in that seat. And yes, the pandemic is still going on. If that is a tool that your family is using, and it is a beneficial tool, I always talk to my parents too about, let's reframe screen time, not as quantity, but quality. So instead of just mindless scrolling through Instagram or TikTok, let's find an app or a program or a masterclass or some sort of YouTube program or something that we can do that's going to pass the time, that's going to be engaging and entertaining, but maybe has a little bit more of a beneficial output than just mindless scrolling. Think about the quality of the TV programs and the Netflix shows and all of those type of things that your kids use. Could you exchange instead of watching, you know, some mindless reruns, could we exchange that time for maybe a couple of more nature shows or something else where the kids are going to be able to learn some facts? Think of where those exchanges could come into place to increase the value of what they're watching on the screen, and anything that they could choose that's also going to have a tactile component. So if you could have, for example, they could do an art class on YouTube that's teaching them to draw, and they could actually be drawing along with the instructor or doing some sort of physical movement or yoga or something like that along with the instructor. Bringing that tactile feel with that screen time to me becomes more educational than entertainment and still has a nice ability to distract and entertain our kids when we need to get some work done.
Dr. Berger, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Natasha Bergert is a pediatrician and spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics. We talked about screen time, maybe putting more limits on, but also granting our kids and our families a little bit of grace right now if you have been relying on your screens a little bit more during the pandemic. Coming up after the news, we're talking about blockbuster hits and summertime classics and what movies always remind you of summer. We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, after 20 years, the United States military will withdraw troops from Afghanistan. Guest host Lee Rayburn reflects on the significance of the ongoing war in Afghanistan and its effect on international relations. That's tomorrow at 8 on the Ideas Network. Now, summer is a great time to get outside, but it's also a great time to go inside, maybe into a movie theater. Some of the biggest blockbuster hits were released in the summer. For example, here's one that was released on June 11th, 1993.
How fast are they?
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh.
Say again.
We have a T-Rex.
Wow.
Put your head between your knees.
Dr. Grant. My dear Dr. Sattler. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
That is a clip from the classic Jurassic Park, directed by Steven Spielberg. I actually remember seeing that in the theater as a kid, and it's just one example of a great summer movie. And we want to hear about your favorite summer classics, or maybe a blockbuster. It could be Star Wars, or maybe it's a sleeper hit that no one has heard of. So call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jocelyn Zapaniak-Gleese is an associate professor of English and film studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship, and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. I always love being on Central Time.
And we always love having you on. Okay, so we are in the middle of summer right now. You know, what really sets apart a summer classic from something that might come out in, you know, late autumn or early winter?
Sure. We can think about a kind of seasonality of movies. And when we think about summer movies, I think at this point, we really think about the blockbuster. In the winter, we go see things that are maybe a bit of Oscar bait, an art house film, something like that. But in the summer, we want to see the big stuff. And so that's really what we think about now in terms of summer films. It is the blockbuster.
So winter, you might see that French noir film, but in maybe the summer, you want to see Transformers. There's a big difference in the seasonality there. You know, how do production companies then plan these new releases in the summer?
Sure. There's kind of a long history about why we might see these giant movies in the summertime. And I want to take a step back just for a moment and talk about the history of what a blockbuster really is and why Hollywood might want to put these films on their slate for the summertime. The blockbuster, it's kind of not just a genre or a movie, but it's kind of cool to think about it as a set of ideas. And those ideas kind of surround spectacle, culture, and economics, and maybe even how we think about the nation, about America in general. So they're really about a visual spectacle that kind of distracts us from the troubles around us and makes us sort of like willing accomplices to the profit machine, which is a bit of a cynical view of the spectacle of the blockbuster, but they can also be a heck of a lot of fun. And they've really been around for quite a long time. We typically point to Jaws in 1975 and then Star Wars and Close Encounters in 1977 as this sort of starting point for the summer blockbuster, which is certainly when summer becomes the time for them. But the idea has a much longer history. As far back as the 30s, the term blockbuster was in use. Sometimes the industry would refer to them as colossals or super colossals, but blockbuster is in use as early as the 1930s. Industry and deciders are using it in the 1940s for all sorts of upcoming movies, comedies, musicals, anything that might draw audiences in. And then Variety starts using the term in 1951 with the biblical epic Quo Vadis, which is not something we might think of as a summer blockbuster today, but it was in 1951.
We are talking to Jocelyn Zapaniak-Gleese right now, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. And we're talking about the history of the blockbuster and, of course, getting some of your favorite summer films. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it also feels like the blockbuster has sort of a militaristic origin. Am I correct there?
You are absolutely right. One of my favorite things to teach about when I teach particularly American film history is all of these fascinating secret connections to the military-industrial complex and our favorite form of entertainment, big overblown movies. And these connections come out in the most fascinating ways. As much as the term blockbuster gets used by the industry and then by film critics, by industry publications, and eventually by audiences, the term originally comes from the military, and it was used quite a bit in World War II to refer to nothing else than large-scale bombing campaigns. I mean, this sounds like absolutely bonkers, but when you think about the associations, it kind of makes sense, right? A blockbuster is something that awes us into submission. It's big, it's bright, it's flashing, it's full of lights. So we've got this term that migrates from the military over to the massive overblown entertainment industry. And then really fascinatingly, this is a point that I think is so interesting here. summer blockbusters then use technology that comes from the military to make their massive special effects. So as an example, Star Wars, which had this really all sorts of really incredible special effects, but the one that it's really most famous for is the swift movement of spaceships through the galaxy. Right before Star Wars, it just kind of looked like ships were sort of hanging like puppets in the air. Star Wars, right? They look, it's like Star Trek. The Enterprise, you know, it's not really doing much. But in Star Wars, the ships are zooming all around. That technology comes originally from an anti-aircraft gun analog camera that the experimental filmmaker John Whitney retrofitted in the 1960s. And then that technology was used by John Dykstra to create Dykstraflex, which is that fabulous effect that we see in Star Wars.
And I want to just deviate for a second. We've seen other technology like that in other films. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Barry Lyndon utilize some sort of NASA camera to get the candlelight going? Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. And that's because it's so hard to do what Kubrick wanted to do with that film. What he was trying to do was use entirely available light. So that would have been daylight, sunlight, but then also candlelight at night. And it's very, very difficult to expose your film with just that kind of light. So you get this kind of ultra sensitive camera used there.
So we are talking to Jocelyn Zapaniak-Galise right now. She's an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee, and we're talking about classic summer movies and big blockbusters. And we want to hear from you right now at 800-642-1234. Maybe your favorite summer movie is Grease, or maybe it's The Fast and the Furious. We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll continue this conversation in just a minute here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our talk with Jocelyn Zapaniak-Galise, an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about classic summer movies. And of course, we just heard The Imperial March from Star Wars. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in with your favorite summer movies. Maybe it's Star Wars. Maybe it's Independence Day. So sticking with the Star Wars theme really quickly, you were talking about that and how the military industrial complex and technology that came out of that era really helped catapult a movie like Star Wars into I guess like the public imagination. Can we talk just a minute about Star Wars?
Sure, absolutely. It's such a fascinating object, mostly because, and this I think is true for so many blockbusters that we're familiar with today, right, from the 1970s on. It's so successful and fascinating and functions as such a great piece of summer escapist blockbuster entertainment. In many ways, because of the incredible technologies that were used in it. And they're technologies that just nobody had ever seen before. I mentioned Dykstraflex, which is this incredible, it's a very complicated motion control system that enabled the special effects technicians at Industrial Light and Magic to make it look like these ships were zooming through the sky. That's actually early microchip control, right? So as early as 1977, we see the use of microchips to make these really, really minuscule movements with the camera and therefore be able to create this tremendous illusion of like intergalactic space fighting in a way that just wasn't possible before. And this, I think, really does point to something else about the blockbuster, which is that it's not just about the story. It's not just about the quality. It's about two other things. One is a sense of kind of universality, right? Because blockbusters, they have to make money outside the borders of the United States. They have to be successful in box offices around the world in order to make the return on investment possible. But they're also about this massive sense of escape as well. And that's kind of a fascinating thing about the movies in general, right? Even these movies that seem like just major popular entertainment, maybe there's not much we can say by way of, you know, their deaths to cinephilia or things like that. But even these kind of massive, overblown popular movies tell us about all these cultural, social, and historical contexts that surround them, and thus how the movies teach us about our own histories and sociocultural contexts.
So I want to stick with the space theme, but I want to move it a little bit closer to home. One movie you wanted to talk about that fits into all of these terms is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which came out in 1977. So let's take a quick listen to a clip from that.
Avez-vous des maux de tête, des migraines?
Having headaches, migraines.
Yeah. Irritation des yeux et du sinus.
An irritation in your eyes and your sinuses.
Yeah. Des démangeaisons, des allergies.
Do you have hives? Do you have allergies?
Des brûlures sur le visage et sur le corps?
You're burning on your face and on your body?
Yes. Who are you people?
Look at this.
Yeah, I got one just like in my living room. Who are you people?
Je pensais...
Monsieur Neri, please, one more question. N'avez-vous pas fait récemment une rencontre?
Have you recently had a close encounter?
Une rencontre plutôt inhabituelle?
A close encounter with something very unusual.
Who are you people?
So, Jocelyn, can you tell us a little bit more about Close Encounters of the Third Kind and what makes this movie a blockbuster?
Absolutely. It's so interesting. Close Encounters comes out the same year as Star Wars and also uses the same kind of motion control technology. So both Star Wars and Close Encounters use this technology from the military-industrial complex, and both of them are also kind of about military action in very, very different ways. So the technology is kind of reiterated throughout the narrative of the film itself. But Close Encounters, wow, the special effects in Close Encounters are some of my favorite effects I've ever seen. They're done by Douglas Trumbull, who makes these beautiful plays of light and movement that are just absolutely sublime on screen. Another thing that I think makes Close Encounters such a perfect blockbuster, besides the fact that it's directed by Spielberg, who is, of course, the king of the summer blockbuster, right, is that, especially as we just heard in that clip, that's François Truffaut talking, right? That's one of the people talking who is one of the major directors of French New Wave cinema in the 1960s. And we get this moment of translation. The entire film is actually about translation and how one can communicate through means other than one's native language. We have Truffaut speaking in French being translated into English, but we also have connection with the aliens via the use of music. So when we think about the film in that way, we can think about it as a utopian kind of space drama where we encounter some kind of mystic revelation with aliens, but we can also think about it as communicating with people from around the world in ways that are not delimited by our specific language. And that's kind of also what a blockbuster does, too.
We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise right now. She is an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. And we are talking about summer classic movies, but also blockbusters. And I want to go back to one of your favorites that would not, I would not have thought of it as a summer blockbuster. And it's kind of genre bending. It's the 1988 live action and animation comedy film, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Let's take a quick listen to a clip from that film.
You wouldn't have any idea where the rabbit might be, Mr. Valiant.
Have you tried Walla Walla? Cucamonga? I hear Kokomo's very nice this time of the year.
I'm surprised you're not more cooperative, Mr. Valiant. A human has been murdered by a tomb. Don't you appreciate the magnitude of that?
And that was a scene where Judge Doom is talking with Private Eye Eddie Valiant. It's a favorite of yours. What sticks out to you about this film in particular?
I mean, besides the fact that Christopher Lloyd plays a secret villain in the cartoon, what more do you need? Well, it's partially because I really love the history of animation. It's one of the courses that I teach at UWM. And this film is so interesting. First of all, it's totally freaking weird. It is totally weird. It is live action actors like Bob Hoskins, and then all the famous animated characters that you can think about from the 20th century. Mickey Mouse, Daffy Duck, Felix the Cat, Betty Boop. Now, what's really interesting about all those characters I just named is that they're all owned by different studios. So all of these characters were created and owned by viciously competing animation studios, right? Studios that were really fighting against one another in the 1920s through really the 1950s. And this is this fascinating moment where the Walt Disney Corporation buys the rights to this novel, which, by the way, is extremely risque. It's a strange object for Disney to be interested in. They buy the rights to the novel, and they somehow convince all of these studios to allow their characters to be in the film. And this had never happened before. Like, Mickey Mouse and Daffy Duck together, that was unheard of. They were able to do it because they thought the movie was going to make a bunch of money. At the time, it was the most expensive animated film ever made, but it did pay off. The gamble paid off, and it did make a lot of money. I just love it for being so utterly weird.
Yeah, it is a very weird movie. I watched it a lot as a kid. I probably should not have. But I, when we started talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, that movie was very strange. But let's shift a little to the actual movie watching experience. Your book is called The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. And one thing that I think about with movies and the summer is getting to just bask in air conditioning. It's one of the reasons I like going to the movies more in the summer than maybe in the winter. How much of a draw was air conditioning for theatergoers?
Absolutely enormous. I mean, so substantial. So substantial, in fact, that people just really didn't go to the movies in the summertime until air conditioning was available. Because think about it, you're sitting in this giant room with a bunch of people sweating, right? That's kind of the last thing you want to do. Right? That's pretty nasty. But in the early 1920s, some massive urban movie palaces start experimenting with certain kinds of cooling systems, but they're so enormous that they require a really significant architectural footprint. It's not really possible for smaller rural or neighborhood theaters to install them. And then Willis Carrier, who is, of course, the inventor of the air conditioning system as we know it now, comes out with a product for the movie theater in the mid-1920s, big movie palaces end up taking that on. And then in the 1930s, a smaller system is debuted, and all sorts of theaters of any kind of size could afford and install this particular system. That's really when we see audiences going to the movies in the summer, because before that, it was just absolute misery. And that's another thing that tells us, I think, you know, this point that I really love to make, the movies are not just about the movies. They're about all the experiences around the movies. They're about enjoying this escape into another world that's both the text of the film, but also the theater itself. This fantasy of being cool, right, in the midst of the hot and dreadful summer. That, to me, is what makes the movies such a fascinating subject to study.
Well, also, you can eat so much popcorn in a sitting in a movie theater that you might not be compelled to at home. So, Jocelyn, we've been talking about the history of the blockbuster, but I kind of want to pick your brain, want you to pull out a crystal ball. And how do you think the blockbuster is going to, you know, evolve maybe over the next 10 or 20 years? Are we going to have Fast and Furious 1000, or could we start seeing some new different movies coming out?
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we do see some new and different ones come out. One of the dangers that we face when making these kinds of speculations is having, you know, having a bit of tunnel vision and thinking it's only about what American audiences want, right? Because as I mentioned before, blockbusters have to not just make money here. They have to make money across the world. So I think in order to predict what we might see, we need to think about what might translate to international audiences. And I think that really is about a balance between what is familiar and what is exciting and new. So I think we will continue to see some kind of like reboots, continuations of franchises. But I also think that So much of it will be driven by what kinds of fabulous new effects technologies are possible. That's the kind of stuff that gets people into the theater. That's the kind of stuff that provides the big bombastic escape that we're used to in the summertime.
Jocelyn, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, I love talking with you. Thank you so much.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is an associate professor of English and film studies at the University of Milwaukee, of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. And we talked about the history of the summer blockbuster and, of course, summer classic movies. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Governor Tony Evers signed the next state budget, which includes a big tax cut that was spearheaded by Republicans. We talked to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White about the budget and what did and did not make it into the state's budget spending plan. That's coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on Central Time, I spoke with outdoor enthusiast Blair Braverman about camping, especially why people who may be on the fence about it should give it a try. And we asked you all on the Ideas Network Facebook page to give us your own camping tips. And while we ran out of time yesterday to get to them during the conversation, I wanted to share some of them today. Emily wrote, start with one night close to home. Wisconsin has beautiful camping in so many unexpected places. And one of the best parts is waking up to the sound of birdsong. A fun story on my end. I heard a loon for the first time in person in the Northwoods on a camping trip last summer. It woke me up and it scared me until I remembered where I was and was really excited once I realized what was going on. And then PJ wrote, try to reserve a campsite with electricity. You'll appreciate having a fan at night. Don't be too proud to bring electronics, especially when camping with kids. And if you're not in too remote an area, bring pizza to the campsite. You don't have to rough it hardcore your first few times. And that is great advice. I once got Thai food while camping and it was awesome. You can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You are listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.